This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu, will.illinois.edu. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in this afternoon. Wendell Jamison is a journalist. He's in the business of asking questions, but he wasn't quite prepared for answering questions posed by his young son, Dean. For example, why do policemen like donuts? So in addition to asking questions on the job, Jamison began investigating his son's questions. Dean got his answers, and his dad wrote a book, Father Knows Less, or Can I Cook My Sister? One dad's quest to answer his son's most baffling questions. Wendell Jamison joins us this afternoon to tell us what he learned about policemen and donuts, among other things. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon. I invite your questions for our guest. We'd also like to hear your stories. How do you answer the tough questions of a child? How were your questions answered by adults when you were a kid? Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number is 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Let me tell you a bit more about our guest. Wendell Jamison is city editor for the New York Times. He lives in Brooklyn with his wife, Helene Stepinski, and their two children, 3-year-old Paulina and 7-year-old Dean. Father Knows Less, or Can I Cook My Sister? One dad's quest to answer his son's most baffling questions includes questions and answers about science, things that hurt, dinosaurs, and good and evil. Father Knows Less is published by Putnam. You can visit Wendell Jamison at his website, www.fatherknowslessbook.com. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Wendell Jamison, good afternoon. Welcome. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for having me.
Oh, my pleasure. This is so much fun.
I'm glad you like it.
And it's also profound.
Okay.
I think.
Well, I think I know what you mean. I can't really bring myself to call my own book profound. But I do think that I did find some deeper meanings and feelings once I dug beneath the surface of a lot of these questions from my son and from other children. I think that you could take the simplest questions, such as the very last question in the book, which a boy named Campbell Robertson would ask every time his aunt brought him gifts. He would say, what else?
Mm.
Pretty simple question. But if you have a Buddhist monk answer that question, as I did in the book, the answer is not only quite profound, talking about the very nature of desire and our desire to always have more than we have, even if we don't necessarily need it, not only profound, but it's quite long. It takes him 4 pages to answer that very simple question. So there were some profound thoughts that we could pull out of these questions from children.
Yeah. It also gives us some insight into how kids learn and how kids express their curiosity and how they get interested in certain things.
It does. And what was so refreshing to me was how unfiltered the questions are. How the questions, they don't worry about political correctness or hurting your feelings or perhaps, you know, offending your delicate sensibilities. They will go straight ahead and ask what they want to ask, when they want to ask it, and haven't learned yet, maybe it's a little tactless to ask, what happens to that man when he gets hung by his neck? Or what does it feel like to get stabbed?
Mm-hmm.
Or what does sexy mean? And so it's just so great in my business, especially, to have people who ask questions straight away. And I try to honor these questions by getting them the true, unexpurgated, unedited answer, even if that answer was perhaps too complicated for a 3- or 4-year-old to understand. This is not a book for small children.
Right.
I like to say it's rated PG-13. It's really for adults who have children, who like children, who are fascinated by children, who respect children, and adults who have their own parents and have known the experience of parenthood and childhood from both angles.
Yeah. One of the first baffling questions your son Dean posed was about pain.
Mm-hmm.
What was that question?
Kids are fascinated by pain, you know. I guess their bodies are their first real sort of possessions and the first things that they really have any control over. So anything that happens bad to the body can cause pain is incredibly fascinating. So Dean and I were standing on a dock, and a little globby jellyfish went floating by, and he said, "What would hurt more, getting run over by a car or getting stung by a jellyfish?" And this was really the first question he asked me that made me think, my son has an interesting little brain here. And I thought it was very funny, and I wrote it down. I thought I'd just write it down, and one day I'd show it to him. But the more I thought about it, the more I thought, what would hurt more, getting run over by a car or getting stung by a jellyfish? So I went to the head of the Division of Pain Management at New York Hospital, Dr. Sudhir Dhawan, and he spent more than an hour explaining to me that he thought it would be the jellyfish, that the nerve pain of a jellyfish can be far more intense than the somatic pain that's really a secondary side effect of having your bones or muscles or tissue crushed by a car. And I was surprised by this, but I also noticed something kind of wonderful, not to mention, if I do say so myself, funny, about taking a very simple, funny, wacky question from a kid and having a very studious, serious, top-of-his-profession doctor answer this question very seriously. And so the more questions Dean asked me, you know, am I allergic to metal? Why do policemen like donuts? They come out at the strangest times. I can't quite tell what motivates them half the time. The more answers I got, the sort of both funnier and more touching it became at the same time.
Yeah.
And so I started writing this book. And, you know, the book, the more I worked on it, the more I thought about my own childhood. Growing up in the late 60s and early 70s, the questions I asked my parents, their techniques for answering my questions, the fact that my life in journalism has been about asking questions and getting answers. So the book sort of morphed into something of a memoir of childhood, a memoir of parenthood. I've only been doing it for about 8 years. I don't pretend to be the world's greatest expert on being a parent, but I've certainly learned a lot in my 8 years. And I've mixed it in with all these questions and answers from children.
Yeah. On-the-job training.
On-the-job training, absolutely.
Yeah.
By the time we figure it out, we're no longer parents. Our kids have, I assume, gone to college.
Yeah. Now, you've taken a different approach to answering your children's questions than your father had with you. Tell us a little bit about your dad and some of the ways that he interacted with you when you had a baffling question.
Well, you know, my parents, and I tried to do this, always treated my sister and myself like adults, like full members of the conversation, full members of the family. And that often involves joking around with people. And he just got a big kick out of giving me sort of made-up answers to my questions. And I'll never forget, I was 5 years old. We were riding in the car. We were on the way, I don't even know where, on the Long Island Expressway, actually out to a little house we rented by the shore. And there was no air conditioning in the car. All the windows were rolled down. It was extremely noisy, just a roar of noise in the back seat. And I said, "Daddy, why is the highway so loud?" And he said, without missing a beat, "Because everybody on both sides of the road has their vacuum cleaners on." And I kind of was satisfied by this. I sort of knew it wasn't true, and yet I didn't really question it. And he did this a lot. I'll never forget, a few years later on Christmas, my sister lost a tooth on Christmas Eve. Now I'm a parent. I know that Christmas Eve is a very stressful time for a parent. There's a lot to do once the children go to close their eyes. And she lost a tooth, and she put it under her pillow. And that particular night, the tooth fairy forgot to come and put the money there. And, of course, in the morning, there were all sorts of lavish gifts for us from my parents, who were very generous. But my sister was fixated on this quarter or whatever it was she was supposed to get for her tooth. And she looked under the pillow, and, of course, the tooth was still there. She went barging into my parents' room and said, "Daddy, how come the tooth fairy didn't come?" And he said, "Maybe she got run over by Santa Claus's sleigh." Which I just, you know, she looked horror-stricken, but my mother and I remember laughing. It was a pretty funny comeback. And it sort of ended the discussion right there. So, and my mother, you know, eventually got into the act, too. You know, part of my book I write about what was going on in the world when I was little, what I was interested in. You know, this was the time of Watergate and the Vietnam War, and a very trying time for the country. And a very strange time to be a small child and sort of wonder about this world where we're in a war, but a lot of people seem to think we're the bad guys and he's the president, but my parents don't seem to like him very much. It was a very curious time to be a child. A lot of the assumptions we make were sort of upside down. And we were all watching the Paris Peace Accords being signed that ended our involvement in the Vietnam War. This was on my father's birthday. And we were watching it in the living room. We were watching men sitting around a giant table signing papers. And I said, "What are they doing?" And my mother said, "They're writing birthday cards to your father." So she really got into the act.
Oh, now, also, we have to say here, though, that if the situation was serious, your parents came through for you. You tell a story early in the book about a question you had watching the news.
Absolutely. I always loved watching the news as a child. I think that I was allowed to watch as much news as I wanted. I Love Lucy and Gilligan's Island and shows like that, my parents limited how much of that I could watch, but I sort of had a free pass to watching the news. I think that's what made me fascinated by the news and probably led me to the newspaper business. And of course, I was watching the news one evening, and there was a war, one of the wars in the Middle East that broke out throughout the 70s. And a man, I forget who, but he said he had been tortured and electrodes had been attached to his testicles. And I screamed into my father in the kitchen, who was with some neighbors who had dropped by, "Daddy, what are testicles?" And he came in and he lowered his voice and he told me. And I remember thinking, my God, you know, what a horrible thing. And, you know, gee, I sort of wished that time he'd made something up.
Yeah.
But he gave it to me straight on that one. And I try and do the same thing for my son and my daughter. She doesn't ask as many questions as he did when he was four. But I try and give Dean the straight answer, and he, of course, knows completely when I'm making something up, because I try and be so outrageous that he could never be fooled.
Yeah, like rolling his eyes kind of and going, "Yeah, right, Dad.
Yeah, right, Dad.
Yeah.
Give me a break."
In this book is in part memoir, and you've mm-hmm. gone back to some of the questions you asked as a boy. Mm-hmm. And one of them I got a kick out of was, "Is John Dean nice?"
You know, that goes back to Watergate.
Yeah.
That summer of, I guess it was 73, was it the summer of 73? The hearings were on TV all summer, and my father was completely transfixed by them. And I didn't quite get what was going on that was so exciting, but I did watch along. And John Dean, you know, this very clean-cut, nice-looking young guy, looked like a very sympathetic character. History has shown him to be something of a hero after he realized what he was doing was wrong. And so I asked my dad, "Hey, is John Dean nice? Kids, my son's always asking, is he nice? Is the president nice? I mean, I guess we want everyone to just be nice, and our parents are nice, our friends are nice. We don't understand a world yet where people are rotten, or some people are." And my dad was very dismissive. "Oh, no, he's terrible. You know, all these guys, Ehrlichman, they're all terrible." But now, 35 years later, I got in touch with James Neal, who was one of the prosecutors in Watergate. John Dean was his witness. He debriefed John Dean. "Was John Dean nice?" I asked him. And he said, "Yeah, he's a very nice guy. He was always very nice to his wife, Maureen." I pushed him a little bit. I said, "You know, do you have a sense of humor? Do you like practical jokes?" And he wouldn't really play ball. I said, "You know, Wendell, this wasn't really a time for much humor. This is a very stressful time for him, but he's a nice guy." So I got my answer 35 years later.
That had to be fun.
It was a lot of fun.
Yeah. This is The Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Wendell Jamison. He's a journalist with the New York Times. He is the author of Father Knows Less, or Can I Cook My Sister? One Dad's Quest to Answer His Son's Most Baffling Questions. This is The Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with your questions for our guest. Perhaps you have a story you would like to share with us. How do you answer the tough questions a child poses? How were your questions answered by adults when you were a child? Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number is 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Well, give us some idea of the kinds of people that you talked with.
Well, you know, that's a good question. I didn't pretend to become an expert and answer these questions myself. I used my sort of journalistic newspaper approach, as we do here at the New York Times, to find the right people who know the answers to the questions we want answered. But I didn't just want someone who had studied the question in school or was a professor or necessarily always a doctor, although I did get Dr. Sudhir Dhawan to answer the jellyfish car run over question. I tried to get people who lived the answer, experienced the answer. I got, for example, the why is the highway so loud, which I asked my dad. I got that answered by Jeffrey Patterson, who's a sound man in Hollywood, who was nominated for an Oscar for his handling of the sound in the movie Twister, which is certainly a movie that has a great deal of wind sound. My son asked me what would it feel like to get stabbed when his little sister was chasing him around the apartment with a plastic sword, so I got a stabbing victim to answer the question. I was trying to get someone whose life experience was the answer. There's a question, why did my hands and feet get wrinkly in the tub, but not the rest of me? I got the magician David Blaine to answer the question. He had recently spent 77 hours underwater as part of a stunt here in New York. And he did know the answer, too. I didn't cheat. I mean, when I approach someone to get an answer, I don't know if they did a little research, but he seems to know it off the top of his head, I have to say. And it has to do with the skin, the two layers of skin. Your skin is a little thicker on your fingers and on your feet. And so as the layers, the inside layer shrinks, the outside layer does not and is forced to pucker to adjust, whereas on other parts of your body, the skin is sort of an equal thinness and it shrinks at the same time.
Yeah. One of the questions is, why do policemen like donuts? Who did you go to for that one, and what was
I went to a policeman. I went to John Timoney, who's a former first deputy police commissioner here in New York City. I knew him from my police reporting days in the early 1990s. He once actually became very angry with me about a story I wrote. I remember him yelling at me in his office in police headquarters. But he's a great guy, a real cop's cop, even a little bit of an Irish accent here in New York City. And so he explained to me that, you know, donut shops are open 24 hours a day. You can always get them. You can always get your coffee with them. And, hey, if you're in your squad car and an emergency call comes in, you can just toss your coffee and donuts out the window and race to the crime scene. And you can always get more when you need them.
Let's talk with the listener now. Caller from Danville on line 4. Good afternoon.
Yeah, hi. Good afternoon, Celeste. Thanks for taking my call. Very interesting program. I have a 7-year-old daughter and a 12-year-old daughter, and I would urge everyone who has kids to write it down because they grow up so fast and they do say the darndest things. I do have one very humorous thing that just bounced into my mind. When I was a kid growing up in the 60s, and my father always gave the quintessential answer, if I asked a question, well, I'll go ask your mother. And we were watching morning news over breakfast, and I think it was the Pittsburgh Pirates who won the World Series. Anyway, the reporter goes, "And there were orgies in the street." So I go, "Dad, what's an orgy?" He goes, "Wow, it's worse than a riot." I'll leave you with that. But it's a very interesting program. Thank you.
That's funny, and yeah, that's such a good point about writing down the questions, because I first wrote down Dean's question just because I thought it was funny. I never had any plan of writing a book. The book sort of grew organically out of that. And when I started working on this project, I decided, listen, I love my son. He's great. He has lots of questions. But I wanted to get the voices of other children into my book, too. I didn't want to be all Dean all the time, especially because children from around other parts of the country might have questions about other things. You know, Dean has his interests. I want children with other interests. But so many times I spoke to people and they said, oh, my son or my daughter has so many great questions. But you know what? I can't remember any of them. And it happened again and again and again. So write it down. Absolutely true. Even if you don't write a book about it, it'll be funny when you come across it in 20 years.
Yeah. What have you learned along the way about how other parents answer their children's baffling questions?
The parents that I ended up working with on this book are perhaps a special group, because these were all people who remembered their children's questions. So by the very nature of them participating, they are parents who listen to their children and who are interested in their children and who get a big, just a genuine kick out of their children, and maybe find their children, frankly, a little tiresome sometimes. You know, people are like, oh, brother, wait till you hear the question Elliot asked. And in fact, there was just a news report about La Jolla I heard before we came on about there has some mudslides there. A kid in the book, Elliot Applebaum, asked a bunch of great questions, and I think he has two or three in the book. His mother must have sent me 20 in the time I was working on the book, and including one of my favorites, Why Do Doctors Have Very Messy Handwriting? And she's crazy about her son, but boy, she's like, oh, brother, he's going to bury me with these questions. So these are all parents, as I said, who really listen to their kids, who are fascinated by their children, who get a kick out of them and want to share that with other people and want to do their best to answer the questions.
Yeah.
And really want to get them real answers. And sometimes, you know, go online or whatever, but when they had a chance to send them to me, they did it right away.
Yeah. When you and your friends who are parents don't have an answer, do you say, that's a good question, I'll have to get back to you?
That's a good approach. Or you can say, let's figure it out. Let's, you know, let's go online.
Mm-hmm.
You give me your mother's laptop, let's Google it and find out. Yeah, but, you know, with Dean, by the time we get to that point, I usually just I have to throw my hands up because here's this technique, and I know a lot of parents listening know this. You answer one question, and it just begets another question.
Yep.
It just begets another question. You go on and on and on until finally you just, you know, I just don't know anymore. So, of course, the right thing to say is, well, let's find out. Let me get back to you on that. But the reality is sometimes you just have to, like, say, stop, enough. Please, eat your dinner.
I need a rest.
I just answered 7 doozies in a row. I don't know the final one.
Yeah. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Wendell Jamison, author of Father Knows Less. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments, stories. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free 800-222-9455. Let's take another call, a listener in Champaign on line one. Hi.
Hi, is that me?
That's you.
Okay. When my two youngest children were 9 and 11, I went to Germany and Switzerland with them. I have relatives in Switzerland, and I had lived in Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And they were just at that age where they noticed differences, and they came up with all kinds of questions like, why do policemen wear green?
Mm-hmm.
Why are the staircases spiral instead of having a landing?
Mm-hmm.
Why are the electric burners on a stove solid instead of in a spiral like ours are? And things
so the,
like...
The traveling really brought out a lot of curiosities in them.
Yeah, and they noticed things like, you know, why are the windows funny? Like they were casement windows instead of double hung. Doors had levers instead of knobs, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
So most of those things, there's not much of an answer to, except that's just the way it developed. So I first told them an elephant joke. Why did the elephant wear red tennis shoes? And it's because the blue ones were in the wash.
Uh-huh.
And so then I told them the policemen wear green because they don't wear blue, which is about why that is.
It may, you know, but it's interesting because you could conceivably find someone who can. There is usually a reason somewhere for something being the way it is, and it's always so much fun to find the person who can explain the history of levers on doors versus knobs, or why some styles of architecture would embrace the staircase that you described and not the staircase we're used to. I mean, in my experience, sometimes it took me a long time, but there was some, at least maybe, theory as to why it had gone one way and not the other. And that was one of the exciting parts of my book. I mean, one question is, does Mona Lisa wear shoes? And boy, did I have a hard time finding an answer for that, but I did find, and as I said, my criteria was finding someone who's lived the answer, not just learned about it. And so I found a medieval footwear expert who is also a reenactor who dresses up in medieval garb from time to time, and he explained that she would have worn shoes and that they would have been what we call turn shoes, sort of like slippers, leather slippers, sort of shoes that they sew, stitch together, and then you turn them inside out. We call them turn shoes. So you can, it's not always the 100% certain answer, but if you spent many months researching it, you might have been able to get some answers for those questions. But, of course, we don't have the time to do that unless we're writing a book for it.
Yeah.
Well, I asked about the staircases, and people claimed it was because they had less space than we have. Though I'm not certain that it actually uses that much less space, but I guess it does.
That's true. Mm-hmm. A cylindrical staircase, I know, in Brooklyn, there's some people who have them because they're just... They do take up a little less space than a traditional straight stairway.
And the stoves would have to do with the strength of the electricity because they have, I think we have 110 and they have 220.
They have more. Yeah. That's true. They have more juice.
So, but as far as the windows, I've never understood why we don't have more casement windows here or more awning windows because I think double hung are a pain in the butt. You know, they get stuck, and you know, the ropes break, and the weights fall down. And
I guarantee you there's someone somewhere out there who's just passionate about window history, that this is this person's thing, because everything, somewhere out there, there's somebody who's just really into it. And that person, if we could find such a person, and hopefully it's someone who's in the window industry, who's actually taken their passion and interest and made it their life's work, who could explain that to you, probably. I bet we could if we had, you know, several months on the show to go do it.
But then I have one other point. My oldest son, my husband and I adopted when he was 10, and we went to Europe almost immediately. And he would ask when he needed to go to the bathroom at a gas station, will you wait for me? And in the category of, you know, such a ridiculous answer that, you know, it can't be so, my husband said, no, we're going to drive off without you. Well, you don't say that to a 10-year-old who has been through maybe a dozen homes. Because...
And so I guess he had a bad reaction to that.
Yeah. He started to cry. You know, but, of course, my husband was coming from a totally different life experience and, you know, figured that was so ridiculous, of course it would be obvious, but it's not always obvious to the other person.
No, that's true. We had to be very careful with these when we are a little sarcastic or make a joke about something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, thanks.
You're very welcome.
I will say, just you might find this interesting, that I said that I had sought to find someone who actually experienced the answer as opposed to just studying it, and I was actually on a radio call-in show here in New York City. And not one, not two, but three people contacted me who heard me on that show saying that they had been both stung by a jellyfish and run over by a car, and that it was the jellyfish that was more painful. So that blew me away.
Phew. Three.
Three. Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
I wish I'd talked to them before I wrote the book.
It's a big city.
It is.
New York City.
Yeah, nothing didn't happen to anyone. Well, maybe the car did. The jellyfish didn't.
Yeah. In
New York City.
Yeah,
so. Yeah.
And not simultaneously.
No, not simultaneously. Well, within a week in each case.
Within a week.
Yeah, within a very close window. Isn't that amazing?
Yeah. Now, when you went to folks and explained what you were doing, what you were after, how did they react?
Well, it was a bit of a challenge. The challenge was to get people to take me seriously and to take the question seriously. Some people thought this was a book for children. It's not. It's a book about children. And so they tried to answer the question in overly simplistic terms. And they tried to water down or sugarcoat what they wanted to say. And it was the real struggle for me to explain that I didn't want an overly complicated answer that no one except an astrophysicist could figure out, but I wanted a full, serious answer, and that was the hardest thing. I went for a couple, monstrously big celebrities I didn't get on board, but I got some pretty well-known people on board. You know, there are celebrities in the book. But the challenge was getting people to take the question seriously, to tell you the truth. I had a question. It was one of the hardest to get answered. Why is there war? I called the head of the Army War College, and he wouldn't get on the phone with me. And then I got a couple of people who I thought would be a snap, which was, retired military men who do commentary for the networks. So they're not only do they have a lot of experience in the military, but they're used to, you know, talking in public and being in the media. And they just overly simplified the question. I remember one guy was saying, you know, oh, why is there war? Well, you know, if you get mad at your friend and he's your friend and you have a fight, but the next day you're friends again, that's sort of what a war is. And I thought, nah, that's too, I don't want that. So I got this great guy, Colonel John Smith at West Point, and I got him on the phone. You know, their press office set me up. I got him on the phone, and he said, I've been trying to answer this question my whole life. And I knew the minute he said that, this was my guy. And we spent a long time on the phone, and he gave me a great answer, one of the best in the book. So explaining, you know, there's, if you want me to go into it, there's, you know, four real reasons, right? There's geographic, you know, economic desire. There's fear that another country wants what you have. There's ideological differences, and there's honor, as in treaties with other nations. And you can mix and match, he said, any one of these reasons. I'd have a little bit here and a little bit there to explain any war we've ever been involved in. And even the war today, you can almost find a little of each of these in the war today, if you want to.
Yeah.
So, but he just gave me, you know, it was an answer that my son, actually, who's almost 8, would understand, but that me as a 41-year-old man would also find fascinating.
Yeah.
That, to me, is the perfect answer.
Yeah. And it also, I think it also speaks to why this is such a tough question and why it's so tough to get out.
Absolutely.
There are, in that section of the book where, you know, there are some really tough questions asked, including that one. There's another one, you know, why are there no lady presidents? And for that, you turn to Pat Schroeder.
Pat Schroeder, as I said, you know, there hasn't been, I want someone who's experienced hands-on the question, not just a professor or something like that of political history. So I went to Pat Schroeder. Actually, Patrick Healy, who's a reporter here at the New York Times, suggested her to me. I would, you know, when I had a good question, I'd go bouncing around the newsroom and asking people who cover that area, who would you recommend to answer this? And he said, oh, Pat Schroeder, she's great. And I called her up and gave me a great answer off the top of her head, bang. And it was, you know, there could be a bunch of different answers to that question. I'm not pretending hers is the only one, but hers, I loved her so much, I just put it in. And she said, you know, other nations have had female rulers, queens, hundreds of years ago. And so they're used to the idea of having a woman in charge. And it's almost a catch-22. We haven't. So we're not used to it. And we do have this concept of commander-in-chief as a strictly military term. And in our history, that's been a male job, a little less so today, but still predominantly. And so we just can't see it because we've never seen it before. Now, I wrote this book. I wrote that to answer that question before Hillary was, you know, in serious contention. I forget exactly when. So maybe things will change this time around. But as of this interview, the reason still is true. We'll see if it changes by the time the paperback comes around.
The next question is also very interesting because it asks, essentially, it asks a couple of questions. One about politicians, and also about, you know, what when we use a word like evil, what do we mean?
Yeah, and isn't that a neat question?
Yeah, that was a great question. Is George Bush evil? Mommy said so.
Now, I left, you know, the mommy said so in there because I think that's an important part of the question.
Mm.
The kid heard this and now wants to know the answer. Now, who do you go to answer a question like that? I couldn't get Beelzebub on the phone. His PR people wouldn't put him on with me. You know, there was no upside for him talking to me, I guess they decided. So in this case, I did go to Professor Malcolm Eccle, who's the director for the Institute of Philosophy and Religion at Boston University, which is my alma mater. And he recently sponsored a multi-year investigation of the concept of evil in philosophy and religion. But I love his answer, because whatever you think about George Bush's politics or policies, he does not fit what would be commonly considered the attributes of an evil person. right? He doesn't engage in pagan rituals, as far as we know, or eat his own children or anything like that. So, like him or not, you can't really call him evil the way the word has been used. But then, like so many people in this book, Professor Eckel takes his answer one step further, and this is what I really enjoy. He says, you know, the philosophy is that the word evil is sort of on the outs right now, because evil has often been used to just describe a culture or a person we don't understand throughout history. In fact, the use of the word evil can almost be an engine for evil itself. You know, I don't understand this other country, I don't understand their religion, they're evil.
Mm-hmm.
And George Bush and Republican presidents, and I'm sure other Democrats, presidents, whatever, other presidents before him have used evil to describe the evil empire or the axis of evil. And they contribute to the use of this sort of dangerous word that in its own use implies a certain ignorance of what this other culture or this other person is all about. I don't understand him, therefore he's evil. So Professor Eckel slightly turns it around back to this little boy's mother and says, I don't want to say your mother is evil, but by calling George Bush evil, she's sort of contributing to the same level of sort of discourse that she probably accuses George Bush of doing.
Yeah.
So I thought that was a great answer.
Yeah, yeah. In these questions, too, you can see what is percolating within the culture.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I didn't want this to be a political book. This is supposed to be a fun book. You know, I'm sort of an apolitical person. A lot of people want to make assumptions about me because I work at the New York Times and make assumptions about the New York Times, which is unfair, I think, and ridiculous. But I did see this question and think, uh-oh. But then when I got the answer that he was not evil, I thought, well, that'll balance it out. You know, but you do see what's percolating through the culture. It goes back to me talking about Nixon when I was little. You know, we live in an age where not everyone likes the president, although I guess that's not a new thing. I know that tons of people hated FDR, and I'm sure every president in history has been reviled by, 48% of the populace. But it certainly seems to be a certain distrust of government, wariness of the man in the White House since I was a child, since Watergate, certainly, in Vietnam.
Early in this book, you note that for children, the world is a blank slate waiting to be asked about. Every long-held assumption and familiar sight to a tired adult, an intriguing and potentially fascinating mystery. Those are your words. A couple of related questions here. Has answering your son's questions led you to think differently about something? Have you found your long-held assumptions challenged?
Yes, I certainly learned in the micro sense a lot of things in this book that I didn't know. I didn't know why we have earwax, for example. But in the larger sense, answering these questions sort of reminded me of the fun of being a kid. And that, we all grow older and we stop asking these questions somewhere along the way. I'm not sure when that moment is, but we stop looking up at and sort of, appreciating the big giant skyscrapers or the giant bridge we're going across or the subway we're riding on, which is really, frankly, a marvel of science. And it reminded me to stop a minute and just sort of appreciate how wondrous the world is. It is sort of the finale of the book that Dean and I go to Chicago to see the dinosaur named Sue at the Field Museum. And Dean was fascinated by dinosaurs and reminded me that when I was his age, so had I been. And one day I lost interest in them, and I don't remember why. And my books got put away, and I dug them out again when he was little. And I was sort of reminded, geez, dinosaurs are pretty fascinating. And I sort of broadened that out to the whole world. You know, the world is fascinating. And another little twist, I think, at the end of the book is that there are some questions that I couldn't get answers to. Why is the dollar sign an S with two lines running through it? There are theories about that it comes from the pesos, which was used before the colonies were colonies, but no one's entirely sure, and there are other theories. And in a way, that was kind of the neat to have some questions that there are no answers to, because that sort of is the end of childhood when you have finally answered all the questions. And in a way, it's more the journey to that dinosaur called Sue at the Field Museum in Chicago that is more fulfilling than actually finding out the answer to why the dinosaur is called Sue.
Let's take one more call here before we run out of time. Listener in Champaign, line one, hi.
Yeah, hi. Question and comment. Who's the professor? How do you spell that guy's gentleman's name?
Our guest
Malcolm
is
David, Malcolm David Eckel.
E-C-K-E-L. E-C-K-E-L. Professor David, did you say?
Malcolm David.
Malcolm David. Okay. Did he do something on PBS a number of years ago, or is this a new... there was a program on PBS a number of years ago on the topic, or is this a different gentleman?
I don't know.
Okay. And aside, I think sometimes the comment applied to world leaders is not so much necessarily today that they're evil, but they're madmen. And I was noticing today there's some sort of truce between North and South Korea. And just recently, the leader, whose name I can't remember, of North Korea is often referred to as a madman, erratic, and this and that. And today he's apparently signing some sort of treaty with the leader of South Korea, or yesterday or so on. And I just think the idea of calling a leader often a madman or this or that has to do more with that we don't understand their behavior or their psychology or are unwilling to invest the effort or time, so on. And I'll just hang up and listen. Thank you.
Okay. You want to comment on it?
It's just a, it's a label that we put on to sort of simplify the world between good and evil and good men and madmen.
Yeah. It's interesting you've included a chapter on language in the book.
So many questions are about language.
Yeah.
You know, everything you say. I remember I was little, my dad used to call everyone Mr. and Mrs. So-and-so, was his expression. And so I thought everyone's last name was so-and-so. but, yes, language is lots of questions about language. And, of course, language is about asking questions and... what is tiki? I'm looking at some of them now.
That's all about how we get along with one another.
That's right.
In the process of working on this book, I suspect it might have changed your ideas about what it is to be a parent. And maybe here to wrap up, you'd tell us the story of how Dean got in your face, you and your wife's face, when you were having quite a shouting match.
Yes.
At your
house. This book is supposed to be a lot of fun. But childhood is not all fun and games, and so I certainly tipped my hat to some of the rougher times I had as a child. My parents, who are still alive, and we are all still good friends, but they did have a very nasty divorce, and they had a lot of fights that led up to it, and it was quite awful for a small child, and I swore I would never do that. And, of course, my wife, Helene, and I did have had a handful of big blowouts in front of Dean. One in particular, which was, of course, over something completely idiotic. I had left my socks around or something. And
of course.
She was mad at me about that, and I felt, hey, I can leave my socks around sometimes if I want. And it just spiraled out of control, and he just yelled at us to stop it, and we stopped it.
Yeah. Out of the mouths of babes.
That's right.
One last question, and I'll have to ask you to give us the short version. Where did the question, can I cook my sister, come from?
It's my fault. My daughter Paulina, she looks very tasty. I often comment on this. And one day before dinner time, everyone was hungry and complaining, and Dean said, why don't we just cook her? And she did not like that at all. And I got a great I couldn't find a cannibal to answer, so I got an archaeology professor in England who explained that, even of the 70 species of mammals that are known cannibals, one would not eat one's own little sibling.
Yeah, no matter how.
There's the answer.
No matter how sweet she is.
Oh boy, and she is tasty. She hates it when I say it, but I can't deny it. I'm probably giving her a complex.
there we have to leave it. Wendell Jameson, thank you so much for talking with us this afternoon.
Thank you so much for having me.
Wendell Jameson is the author of Father Knows Less, or Can I Cook My Sister? One Dad's Quest to Answer His Son's Most Baffling Questions. The book is published by Putnam. You can visit our guest, Wendell Jameson, at his website, www.fatherknowslessbook.com.